It's the NPR News Update Podcast. Good Wednesday, May 7th. I'm Phil Picardi on Twitter, at PicardiMPR. Details on Senate passage of medical marijuana coming up. Also details on Sunday growler sales, long-term Minnesota unemployment, and a new report on climate change. All ahead on the podcast. First, a proposal to legalize medical marijuana has moved forward, but has an uncertain future in the state legislature. The state Senate voted 48-18 yesterday for a bill that allows certain patients access to cannabis in pill and liquid form, but not smoking. The Senate measure does not have the blessing of law enforcement or DFL Governor Mark Dayton. Tim Pugmire reports.
In presenting his bill, DFL Senator Scott Dibble of Minneapolis said medical marijuana could help thousands of Minnesotans who are living in pain and discomfort. Dibble said those patients should not have to seek out marijuana illegally.
We're asking, in this case, to allow Minnesotans the same freedom that citizens of over 20 other states have. In the name of compassion, the name of having access to something that can make a real difference for the better for some people.
Under the bill, qualified patients would be allowed access to medical cannabis in pill or liquid form. Vaporizing would be allowed, but not smoking. Debilitating conditions eligible for the treatment option include cancer, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV, AIDS, ALS, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Of the 21 states with medical marijuana laws, none of them prohibit smoking. Dibble made the change last week to address the concerns of opponents. He said patients would still have the vaporizing option.
It doesn't allow the substance, whatever it is, to be heated up to the point of combustion, but it does allow the substance to be heated up to the point where, just shy of combustion, the compounds are released and you can inhale them and utilize the product in that form of fashion, an important way for some folks with some conditions to be able to use medical cannabis.
Qualified patients or their caregivers would need state-issued ID cards to obtain cannabis. The bill allows for the manufacturing and distribution of cannabis throughout the state at up to 55 locations known as alternative treatment centers. The Senate passage of a medical marijuana bill came less than 4 weeks after Governor Dayton challenged lawmakers to stop avoiding the issue. His comment triggered fast-track consideration of a bill that had been dormant. Republican Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen suggested that some DFL infighting was actually driving the bill.
At the expense of all Minnesotans who should be watching us dealing with more important issues, such as roads and bridges and bonding projects, we're meddling around in here, trying to prove a point within the ranks of the leadership.
Ingebrigtsen, a former sheriff from Alexandria, spoke at length against the bill. He claimed it was the first step toward the legalization of recreational marijuana. Republican Senator Carla Nelson of Rochester said a lack of research made the proposal premature.
It's really built on sand. It's built on shaky ground because we do not have the scientific information that can allow doctors to use best practices in prescribing particular pharmacologic drugs for specific use. And that is what is missing today, members.
DFL Senator Chuck Wieger of Maplewood said he used to have concerns about the bill, but Wieger said he changed his mind last week after learning that his uncle is battling cancer and dealing with a lot of pain.
For God's sake, if people are suffering and we have the ability to provide a way to alleviate that pain, let's hear their concern. Let's hear their prayer.
The Minnesota House will vote later this week on a much different medical marijuana bill. The House measure, known as the Medical Cannabis Therapeutic Research Act, would authorize a limited observational study of medical cannabis in liquid and pill form. There would only be one manufacturing and distribution location. Law enforcement groups that oppose the Senate bill are neutral on the House bill. Governor Dayton has not yet weighed in on the House bill.
Tim Pugmire at the state capitol. Also there, Tom Scheck, and he has a report about the future of a bill that would change some of the state's liquor laws. The legislation is in jeopardy after senators argued over alcohol sales on Sundays. The Senate voted to allow tap rooms to sell containers of beer called growlers on Sundays over the objections of Senate DFL leaders who oppose Sunday sales. The vote prompted the chief sponsor of the liquor bill to pull it from consideration. Here's Tom.
A bipartisan group of senators voted to amend the liquor bill to allow craft breweries to sell 64-ounce growlers of beer on Sunday. Republican Senator Dave Osmek said his amendment would help small craft brewers across Minnesota.
This is not something that needs to have massive amounts of distribution. They're simply small businesses that fill bottles with very good beer, and they create great jobs for Minnesotans.
The amendment should be familiar to the chief sponsor of the liquor bill, since it was in his bill until early Monday morning. That's when the Senate Tax Committee voted to remove the so-called Sunday growler provision from the bill. Members of the Teamsters Union objected to that provision. They said allowing Sunday growler sales could force a reopening of their contracts with liquor distributors, which could put pay and working conditions back on the bargaining table. Other critics said they were concerned that allowing Sunday growler sales would only open the door to a broader push for Sunday liquor sales. DFL Senator Rod Scoy of Clearbrook said he's against any Sunday sales. He said people should plan better if they want to drink beer at home on Sundays.
It seems to me that we're not thinking about this as a good policy for the state of Minnesota. It seems to me that people should be able to plan just a little bit ahead to have these that they want for their utilization.
The Senate agreed with Scoy on a proposal to repeal the Sunday sales ban across Minnesota and on an amendment that would have allowed cities to decide whether Sunday liquor store sales could occur. But members voted 43-21 in favor of Sunday growler sales. Immediately after the vote, DFL Senator Jim Metzen of South St. Paul moved to table his bill. He said he warned his colleagues that would happen if the growler provision was adopted.
And that's and it was in there, so I, we'll see. All I can say is it's work in progress.
Metzen said he'll continue to look for ways to revive the liquor bill without the growler provision. He said other important measures, such as extending bar closing time during the Major League Baseball All-Star Game in July and giving the University of Minnesota its preferred method of selling alcohol at TCF Bank Stadium, are included in his bill. But DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach said there's no guarantee that the liquor bill will resurface in the Senate in the final 12 days of session. Bach also warned that taprooms pushing for growler sales may lose their bid to open on Sundays at all, which is also included in the liquor bill.
Well, they're likely to get nothing out of this session. And that's a decision they'll have to make, whether the growlers are worth losing the Sunday taproom sales.
Bach also said a conference committee focused on the budget will likely amend its bill to authorize the U of M to continue alcohol sales at its football stadium, where the Vikings will also play for two seasons starting this fall. The House liquor bill also includes the Sunday growler provision. The House author said earlier this week that he was waiting to see what action the Senate would take before deciding whether he'll move the bill with the growler provision in it.
Tom Scheck in St. Paul. A new report from the White House on climate change says problems related to global warming will become increasingly disruptive across the nation for the remainder of the 21st century and beyond. The National Climate Assessment breaks down the possible consequences of climate change by state and by region. Among other things, the report says extremes of rainfall, drought, and heat could harm rural and urban areas alike in Minnesota and cause major changes in the northern forests. Matt Sepik has more.
Anyone who grows food, whether row crops such as corn and soybeans or backyard tomatoes and cucumbers, knows the growing season in the upper Midwest is short. But the White House report says Midwesterners can expect a longer growing season if climate change continues along its current path. At first, that might sound like a good thing, but J. Drake Hamilton at the St. Paul environmental advocacy group Fresh Energy says extreme weather events will offset any benefits.
We're seeing later frosts than many years, which can take out some crops, and an increase in crop diseases that used to be pushed back by our tough winters. We're now seeing some crop pests show up in Minnesota and be able to thrive in Minnesota that didn't used to be able to make it across the Iowa border.
Hamilton says the good news is that Minnesota has been a leader in reducing greenhouse gases on the state level, first with energy efficiency legislation and with the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007, which requires Minnesota utilities to get 25% of the power they produce from renewable resources by 2025. Xcel Energy Vice President of Policy and Strategy Frank Prager says the utility must meet an even higher renewable standard.
We have installed about 1,900 megawatts of wind in Minnesota. And we have also retired several of our aging coal plants, and we've implemented some of the nation's leading energy efficiency and conservation programs. We're, in fact, in the process right now of adding another 750 megawatts of wind to our system.
Solar use has to increase, too. A law enacted last year requires utilities to produce 1.5% of their electricity using solar by 2020. The 100-megawatt Geronimo Energy Aurora project is expected to boost Minnesota's solar output eightfold. All statewide energy and climate change initiatives must go through the legislature. At the Minnesota Capitol, the White House climate change report is getting a mixed response. State Senator Michelle Benson is on the Environment and Energy Committee. The Ham Lake Republican says the president is pandering to environmentalists.
If there is climate change, what is it going to do? Are people causing it? And if people are causing it, to what level are we willing to change our lives in order to stop the climate change?
The public is pushing us now.
DFL Representative Gene Wagenius of Minneapolis chairs the Environment Finance Committee in the Minnesota House.
10 years ago, they weren't pushing us at all. 5 years, a little bit, but now I can feel the public pressure.
The report says the composition of the region's forests could change as rising temperatures change the habitats for many trees. Lee Frelich heads the University of Minnesota's Center for Forest Ecology. Frelich says in the North Woods, red maple trees from more temperate parts of the state are displacing pine, spruce, and fir trees. He says the loss of boreal forests could affect all species in the ecosystem.
And that cuts across all taxonomic groups, not only trees, but wildlife species, birds, insects, plants, mosses, fish.
Frelich says wet summers in recent decades actually have pushed the border between the prairie and forest south. But he says if climate change continues at its current pace, that could reverse and the line could creep past the Canadian border. And if it gets hot enough, Frelich says, the forests of the boundary waters could eventually become grasslands.
Matt Sepik on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Unemployment in Minnesota is running far below the national average, but it's still taking many Minnesotans an unusually long time to find work. Nearly 40,000 workers in the state have been job hunting for 6 months or more. That's more people than you'll find in most Minnesota counties. Annie Baxter reports.
Every Monday morning at 7:15, before most people with jobs punch in for the day, hundreds of Minnesotans gather to help each other find work.
Good morning. First time with us?
No.
They're part of a job transition group at Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie. They share leads and ideas, take seminars on resume writing, and offer each other spiritual support.
Father God, we thank you so much for the privilege that we have of coming together to work together to find a job. And Father, for some it's been a long process.
That's true of Vicki Pond, one of the job seekers here on this day. A year and a half ago, Pond lost her job in the compliance department of an insurance company. She was part of a mass layoff. Pond's now pursuing a bachelor's degree because she's worried her associates isn't enough. But it's not clear if that's the problem.
I'm told by some people that, well, we really are looking for somebody with a bachelor's or a master's degree. And then other people, I'm being told I'm overqualified.
As workers like Vicki Pond struggle to understand the reasons for their long-term unemployment, experts are puzzled too. It's not a familiar problem.
Long-term unemployment, you know, until the Great Recession, it was sort of a European phenomenon that we didn't think we really had to deal with.
This is Judd Kramer. He's co-author of a recent Brookings Institution study on long-term unemployment. Kramer says about one-third of the nation's jobless workers have been looking for work 6 months or more. That portion is historically high. And he says even in states like Minnesota, where the jobs recovery has been decent, long-term unemployment remains stubbornly elevated. 25% of Minnesota's unemployed workers count as long-termers. That's led Kramer and his co-authors to a sobering conclusion. Job growth alone doesn't solve the problem.
We don't think, and we don't have the statistical evidence to really back up the claim that all we need is the labor market to improve and then the situation will, for the long-term unemployed, will go away.
Kramer and his colleagues think two big factors are making long-term unemployment so entrenched despite economic improvements. On the one hand, workers lose their skills and morale the longer they're out.
They're more likely to be susceptible to breakdowns in family, to increase in depression, and to all of these other factors that sort of hinder their ability to not only find jobs, but then to hold jobs in the long term.
And Kramer says there's strong evidence that employers discriminate against workers who've been out of work a long time.
Sometimes that thought comes up and I go, you know, it's been a while, and I get a little anxious.
Colleen Towns was part of a mass layoff at SuperValu and has been out of work 9 months. But she's not too worried yet about being stigmatized.
I know people who have so far been out twice as long as I have been, and they've landed fantastic positions.
The Brookings Institution study suggests the best way to help the long-term unemployed may be to retrain them in fields that are growing. The report says workers aren't doing that much on their own so far. But Colleen Towns is. She's pursuing a certificate in medical coding and billing to add to the bachelor's degree she already has in finance. She hopes the effort will open more doors and show employers she's not someone who's languishing in long-term unemployment.
Annie Baxter for us. Minnesota has a lot at stake in a new food labeling initiative. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is proposing to overhaul the nutrition label found on food packaging. And there is a lively debate over the new labeling requirements that could affect the fortunes of big Minnesota employers like General Mills, Hormel Foods, Michael Foods, and Schwan Food Company. Martin Moylan has the details.
When Amelia Fontarius goes grocery shopping here at the Mississippi Market on West 7th Street in St. Paul, she spends a lot of time scouring labels for nutrition and ingredient information.
I drive my husband crazy because it takes me forever to grocery shop.
What does she look for?
Salt content, if there's any hydrogenated corn oils or any hydrogenated anything. So trans fat, if I can figure out anything about the GMOs. The nutrition label is a little bit helpful, but you really have to research more on your own.
The FDA is proposing changes intended to help folks like Fontarius know more about what's in prepared foods. Among other things, the updated label would include information on potassium, vitamin D, and how much sugar is added during production. FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg announced the proposed changes in March.
We realize that the label alone won't magically change how America eats, but we hope that once consumers decide to implement changes in their diet, it will provide them with the tools to be successful.
Once the rules are finalized, food companies could have up to 2 years to comply. But for now, there's disagreement among industry and consumer groups about what should be on the new labels. Some consumer advocates argue new labels should be much more informative than the FDA has proposed. Laura McCleary is the chief regulatory affairs attorney at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. She says the FDA should mandate one proposed version of the label, a format that identifies ingredients to be avoided or consumed to reduce the risk of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease.
The format tells consumers what nutrients on the label they should avoid, like saturated fats and added sugars, which nutrients they should get enough of, like beneficial carbohydrates.
But McCleary's position is just one of many. The FDA has already had more than 2,500 consumer and industry comments on the proposed changes. The FDA had planned to take comments on the label changes until only early June, but many industry groups are seeking a 90-day extension of the comment period to study the impact on manufacturers. Cranberry growers, for example, have lamented that quantifying added sugars would punish cranberries for their, quote, unpalatable natural state. Minnesota food companies such as General Mills, Hormel, Schwan's, and Michael Foods have hundreds of product nutrition labels to update. So far, no comments from Minnesota firms have shown up on the FDA's website, but they certainly won't stay quiet.
We're looking forward to sharing our perspective on the proposed changes soon.
Maha Tahiri is General Mills' Chief Health and Wellness Officer. Since 2005, the food industry giant says it has improved the health profile of products that account for nearly three-quarters of its U.S. sales. The changes include increased protein, fiber, vitamins, and minerals, or reduced calories, sodium, sugar, and fat.
We have found that consumers are increasingly seeking healthier options as long as taste is not compromised.
Tahiri says gradual improvements make the most sense since too great a change in ingredients in a short time can alter a product's taste so much that people stop eating it. She says the company refers to the slow changes as stealth health. But consumer interest in healthy ingredients is hardly stealthy. Hank Cardello is director of obesity initiatives for the conservative-leaning research group, the Hudson Institute.
There is a clamoring for healthier products. It's very clear to us that the growth in the industry over the last 5 years has predominantly come from these better-for-you and lower-calorie products.
Regardless of the new labels, Cardello says companies are not acting in their shareholders' interest if they're not developing and promoting healthier foods.
Martin Moylan is an NPR business reporter. He's also been following the Target story. Shares of Minneapolis-based Target fell almost 4% yesterday. That followed a drop of 3.5% on Monday when Greg Steinhoffel announced he's stepping down as the retailer's CEO. And one possible successor has said he won't be in the running to replace Steinhoffel. Here's Marty.
Target's interim CEO, John Mulliken, told Bloomberg News he's not a candidate for the permanent job. Mulliken, an 18-year Target veteran, has been the retailer's chief financial officer. On Target's website for employees, Mulliken said that while he's got the top job, he will not aim to simply keep the ship afloat, but will accelerate the company's growth. He said customers will see a more flexible Target, able to give customers products whenever and however they want them. Target has hired an executive search firm to find a new CEO, but not disclosed a timeline for the process. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Dayton has signed legislation that gives the Minnesota Department of Health the authority to store newborn screening samples and test results indefinitely, unless a parent objects. Here's Lorna Benson.
Minnesota's newborn screening program tests for more than 50 rare conditions that could be harmful or fatal if not treated early in life. The new law removes the state's 2-year time limit on storing those test results. It also gets rid of the 71-day limit on archiving newborn blood spot cards. A dozen medical organizations and societies backed the legislation. They said long-term storage assures that doctors and families can access the data for future health-related testing, and they argued that the archive is a critical resource for developing new screening tests. Parents will have to fill out paperwork if they want to opt out of the health department's default storage program. The law's critics said that puts an unreasonable burden on families. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Metropolitan Council and the City of Minneapolis have hired a mediator to help bridge their differences over the proposed Southwest Light Rail line. Curtis Gilbert reports.
Retired federal judge Arthur Boylan has helped resolve seemingly intractable standoffs before. He brokered the compromise that ended the 2011 National Football League players' lockout. Bringing in Boylan shows how difficult the negotiations between Minneapolis and the Met Council have become. But it also suggests the parties want to find a way to make a deal. The Met Council voted last month to run part of the Southwest Light Rail line through shallow tunnels as it passes between Cedar Lake and Lake of the Isles. Minneapolis opposed that plan and now has to decide whether to go along with it or stand in the project's way. The Minneapolis City Council has until mid-June to make its decision. The Met Council hasn't said how much the mediation will cost. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minneapolis has officially made its bid to host the 2018 Super Bowl. Tim Nelson has more.
The city is in the running with Indianapolis, which hosted the game in 2012, and New Orleans, which hosted the 2013 Super Bowl. Michelle Kelm-Helgen is chair of the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority, the state agency building a new NFL stadium downtown.
There'll be over 100,000 people that come to the city for the Super Bowl.
So it obviously is a big influx of people, and it's a very major event to plan for.
The stadium is expected to be completed in time for the Vikings season starting in 2016. NFL officials will choose the host city for the 2018 Super Bowl in about 2 weeks. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And we close out the podcast with a report. The last ice is slowly receding from the northeastern Minnesota lakes, just in time for the walleye fishing opener. Dan Crocker has more.
Last year, the ice didn't break free from Lake Winnebogoche, a big walleye lake outside Grand Rapids, until 4 days after the opener. This year, Gail High, who owns Bowen Lodge, says the ice is clearing just in the nick of time.
This year is looking really good. We are getting our docks in, and there's a lot of open water on Winnie.
Farther north, there's more ice. Resort owners on Lake Vermilion expect some floating ice this weekend, but say boats will still be able to launch. Ray Ingebrigtsen, who owns Aspen Resort on Pelican Lake in Orr, predicts the ice will clear by Saturday, but he says the uncertainty is keeping anglers away.
I know after last year having to cancel some people for opener, we don't have anybody coming in for opener this year. They're a little skittish, I think.
But the ice is officially out on Gull Lake near Brainerd for Governor Dayton's fishing opener on Saturday. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
And that's the news for this May the 7th. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for joining me for the NPR News Update podcast. I'll have more news right back here on Thursday.